Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
We have a mission for you. To help our podcast stay free to download with minimal ads, we would appreciate your participation in a Podcast One survey. Either go to podcastone.com/mysurvey or visit Podcast One, that's podcastone.com, and click on the survey banner. That's it!
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm staff writer Megan LaBrice.
Today we're really thrilled. We're going to be talking to Angie Thomas. You might know this young adult novel, The Hate U Give. It's only been on the bestseller list for, 68 weeks.
Or something,
just that little old thing. So, and the film is going to come out this fall.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about that.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited about this interview too.
Yeah, the studio released the first few sort of behind-the-scenes shots from the production, so fans of the novel have gone a little cuckoo looking at those. But we talked to Angie at Book Expo, which just happened a few weeks ago. That was the publishing industry's big annual trade show, and she was nice enough to spend some time with us. It was great to meet with her because she kind of... It seems like she came out of nowhere. I mean, I think she had been rapping before she published The Hate U Give. But it's just such a great thing to have seen the success for this debut writer, particularly with a young adult novel that deals with some really, tough stuff. I mean, police brutality, murder, racism. But she just tackles it all head on.
Yeah, and it's a really formidable book. If you haven't read it yet, immediately run out and get it. That it's one of those. It's one of those that everybody should read.
And also, we should say, whether you're a young adult or not. I mean, it's...
Yeah, that's true.
This is a great read for adults, too.
Also, I would caution us against overemphasizing her rap career, though, because as she told us in person, it was kind of something she did a little bit to be cool.
Well, now she's really cool.
No, now she's the coolest.
All right. Well, let's cue up that interview.
Start out with, I mean, the book has been out for a while. It's been a bestseller for a very long time. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
It's The Hate U Give, and we're talking to Angie Thomas. But for anyone who, like the few people who haven't read it, tell us a little bit about what it's about and maybe how the idea for it came to you.
The Hate U Give is about a 16-year-old star who lives in these two very different worlds, the mostly black poor neighborhood where she lives and the mostly white upper class private school that she attends. And the struggle of being two different people in two different worlds becomes even harder when she's the sole witness of her childhood best friend Khalil being killed by a cop. Khalil was unarmed, and what Star does or does not say could not only change her community, but it could end her life. I first got the idea for the book when I was a senior in college. I went to a school similar to Star's, but it was college. It was a mostly white upper class private school in Mississippi. And I lived 10 minutes away in a neighborhood that was a lot like Starr's. So I often say I would leave my neighborhood where you have like the chicken joints where you can get a 10 piece for $5. Mm-hmm. And then I go to where my school is and they have the hipster places with the thigh for $40 with a sprig of rosemary on it. Mm-hmm. You know. So it was, you know, it was going between two different worlds. You know, in my neighborhood, there were abandoned houses and stuff. And at my school around the neighborhood, there were these huge homes with chauffeurs and stuff like that. And I felt like I had to be a different person in this world. But my struggle became harder when a young man by the name of Oscar Grant lost his life in Oakland, California. I didn't know Oscar personally, but the reactions around his death really spoke to me. I had classmates who didn't understand why people were so upset that they would riot and protest over an ex-con's death. Yeah. So in my anger and frustration, I wrote a story that later became The Hate U Give in order to hopefully help them understand it a little bit better.
So it started as a story, like a short story?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow. And what? How, I mean, it's a YA book. There's quite a bit of plot. It's great. Did you squeeze all that into a short story, or?
No, the problem was when I was writing the short story, my professor, I would turn part of it in every week, and he would go, "Darling, this is supposed to be a short story. Keyword, short. You're adding too many plots. You're adding too many characters. You got to pull back a little bit." I was like, "Yeah, but I got so much to say." He said, "Well, maybe you should turn it into a novel one day." He's an author himself. His name is Howard Barr. And now he feels as if I owe him a check. But no, it did. It started as a short story. I had to really condense it. And it was really just Khalil's perspective and Star's perspective. And I didn't get to go into the neighborhood as much as I would have liked. So when I got a chance to turn this into a novel, I ran with it. It really, everything that I wanted to do before, I was finally able to do.
I was thrilled to learn that you were one of the very first beneficiaries of a grant from We Need Diverse Books.
Yes.
I've had the privilege of interviewing Danielle Clayton and Lamar Giles for this podcast.
Yes.
And they're both wonderful people. And I was wondering, what was that like for you? First of all, how did you hear about it? And what did it mean to you as pre-publication, you know, author?
Yeah, I first heard about the grant through social media. And I remember because when I first heard about the grant, that was actually my first time hearing about We Need Diverse Books. And I was in awe of the fact that there was a group of people who were fighting to get diversity into publishing. And they weren't just talking the talk. They were walking the walk. They're like, "Here, we want to help someone who's trying to get published with money, you know?" So I wasn't sure, though, what would come from it. You know, when you do things like that, you never know, you know. So I sent it, and I forgot about it. I submitted all of my materials, and I forgot about the whole thing. And it was months later, after I'd signed with my agent, all of a sudden I get an email, and they're like, "Congratulations." I'm like, "Congrats for what? Wait." And I won. I was one of the winners. And it was a huge help for me at the time because I was in the middle of working on edits on the book with my agent. And my laptop at the time was awful. It was literally held together with tape. Like, I literally was holding the screen together with tape. And, like, I had to tilt it a certain way to really see things. And keys were coming off. And, like, my mom would look over my shoulder. She's like, "Where's your K?" I'm like, "Don't ask about it." So it allowed me to get a new laptop. But also, it gave me a boost of confidence because here it is, this award that's granted and is judged by all of these publishing professionals. And they're like, "Wow, you have something special here. Here's some money." You know, that really does give you a boost of confidence. So I definitely encourage aspiring authors from diverse backgrounds to go after that grant. It does a lot, not just financially, but it does help you with that boost of confidence. And it really does give you a little, a little more credit, when you do go out there with your book. It's like, "Yeah, I want a grant." So yeah, you do want me, don't you? It's not guaranteed, but still.
Yeah. No, that's great news. So it's interesting that you talked about these two different settings, not just in the novel, but in your own life. Because in the novel, a precise geographical setting isn't crucial. And I just was wondering why that is. I mean, we can't really call it a Southern novel, an LA novel. You know, tell me why, what your thinking was there.
Oh, that was definitely done on purpose. I wanted to say that, unfortunately, this could happen anywhere. But I also wanted to show that neighborhoods like Garden Heights exist everywhere. It's interesting to me, as readers read the book, I've had people come up to me and they're like, this is Atlanta, isn't it? Or where I'm from, Jackson. People in Jackson are like, this is definitely Jackson. Like, the kids there swear is Jackson, you know. And then I've had people in California, oh, this is LA, right? This is South Central. This is that. So it shows me too that there are these communities that share a thread. They're so similar and they have so many similarities. Yeah, they're different, but they have that heart, that same heart about them. So it showed me that in a lot of ways the experiences are universal. But I definitely did that on purpose. And I'm glad to see that it has made people say, huh, well, you're right. It doesn't really take place somewhere, but that could have been my neighborhood, my community. And now they're like, huh, that could have been my kid. Huh, yeah. That could have been someone I knew. Oh, wow, this is actually more personal than I realized.
Right.
So it was done on purpose.
Yeah.
But I will say for the movie version, they had to give it a city and state. It's fictional, but still. But yeah, I like that fact that now I still have people coming up to me saying, isn't this in this place? And I'm like, nope. And they're like, oh, dang it.
Because usually when we interview writers, we hear that people they know in real life approach mm-hmm. them after the book has come out and, you know, suggest that they are the inspiration for particular characters. Has that happened to
you? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There is a restaurant in the book that is inspired by an actual restaurant in Jackson. And the owners of the restaurant read the book and they were like, that's us, isn't it? And yeah, it was. So they put my picture up on the wall, but they won't give me free food.
What?
I know. All that free advertising. It's okay. But no, there are characters who were inspired by real life people. Like there's this character in the book named 40 Ounce, inspired by a real life person. And he hasn't read the book because he claims he's going to wait for the movie. And I'm trying not to be offended. But he said, I heard there's a character in there based on me. And I was like, yeah, okay, where's my check?
Yeah.
No, sir, it does not work that way. So I definitely took people from my real life and put little bits and pieces of them into different characters.
Yeah.
Well, at the restaurant in the book, of course, if you get good grades, you might get some free food.
Yeah.
So if you go back to school, will you get some free food?
You know, I don't know. I think he probably see past that.
She should be teaching school. Not going to.
Well, that's true. So we're talking about your readers and how they're mm-hmm. from all over the place, you know, and they can see themselves in this story. I've read and listened to some other interviews with you, and you have a significant population of readers who might not even identify as readers, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
That's amazing. Just a few minutes ago, before I came here, I had a librarian come up to me, and she said that her most reluctant readers devoured my book. And it's like the one book for some of them that they've ever read from beginning to end. And for me, that's incredible to know that there are kids who they did not connect with books, and suddenly they found one that they connected with. If I lit that spark in them, I am totally proud to do that. But these are also the kids that usually, there was a time where these were the kids where publishing said, oh, well, they don't read. They don't like to read. So why should we appeal to them so much? The fact is, they do love to read if you give them something they connect with. And they're proving people wrong. So for me, the greatest compliment I ever get is when a kid comes up to me and they say, yo, I hated reading, but I read this in a day. You know, I had a teacher send me a note that one of her students sent her, and he was like, I hate reading, but I'm loving this, and I kind of hate myself right now because I'm loving this so much. What are you doing to me? And I'm like, that's the magic of it.
That's great. Well, it's interesting because I've heard people in publishing sort of speak of you as a pioneer in that context, mm-hmm. not just because of getting really reluctant readers to read, but, you know, the characters that you write about and sort of the honesty with which you write. Does that feel weird to you to be thought of as a pioneer?
It is, because I can think of all the people who opened the doors before I got there.
Yeah.
And for me, I just tried to do my best to almost emulate them. You know, I'm mm-hmm. a huge fan of Jacqueline Woodson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I'm like, I'm not a pioneer. Those are the pioneers, you know.
Yeah.
But if I've done anything at all, I am thankful and humbled to know that it has inspired people or it has opened doors. But I look at respect the people who open the doors for me beforehand, and those are the ones that I bow to, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's weird when people tell me that. Honestly, it really is. I'm like, me?
Yeah. You mentioned a little bit earlier in the conversation that Star is kind of moving between two worlds, but she is one distinct character. Mm-hmm. She is, there's nobody like her in literature. And I was wondering, what are some of the things you love about her most?
One thing that I do love about Star is that she comes to be unapologetic. I won't say she starts out that way, but she comes to be unapologetic. And I do, one of the things I absolutely love is the foundation that she has with her family. I feel as if for Star to be the way that she is, it takes having parents like Lisa and Maverick. It takes having a dad like Maverick, a mom like Lisa. It takes them instilling those things into her that makes her who she is. For me, I love writing the character. I think too, it was hard at times, I can't lie, because of what she was dealing with. But for me, you know, her name, her dad named her Star because she's light. For him, she was his light in the darkness. And that's exactly what I wanted this character to be. We're talking about a very dark subject. But if young people can look at her and see her and say, wow, she decided to speak up and speak out in the midst of this, maybe I can too. That's an accomplishment for me. It's now when I hear young people who like walk out in their classes to protest gun violence. I had a teacher say that her student said, what would Star do? I'm like, wow. That's amazing. But here's the thing. They see that she started out fearful. And they understand that. And they see that she was scared to do it. And they get that. And that's what I wanted to show. That, yeah, this young person is just like you. And she finds her voice. So you can too.
So she's got Lisa and Maverick. And she also has a secondary father figure in Uncle Carlos.
Yes.
Who's kind of like, he's also a strong black man.
Yeah.
But in a completely different way than her dad.
Yeah, Carlos is probably one of my favorite characters. Yeah. I often say, and this is me being a Fresh Prince fangirl, Carlos is Carlton, Maverick is Will. You know, they're two different people. They talk different. They present themselves differently. But they are both strong black men, and they're both intelligent black men. And even down to the way that they speak differently. Maverick says, all right. Carlos says, all right. But guess what? They're both intelligent, and they're both positive people in Star's life. So for me, those two characters are like two sides of the same coin. Maverick's a little rougher. Carlos is a little more conscious of how he presents himself, but they have that same influence in Star's life, and I think that they are equally important in her life. And so I wanted to show through them that there is no single way to define blackness. Here are these two black men. They're strong and they're powerful, and they just present themselves in different ways.
Yeah.
What you really drove home for me throughout this whole book is, like, no matter where you're from or how you're talking or if you're talking differently the next day or what you're wearing or what you're doing, like, you are you.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I get a lot of young people, specifically young black people, who come up to me and they're like, people say I'm not black enough because I talk a certain way. But I have to tell them, there's no single way to be black. Your blackness is not defined by how you speak. And I really wanted to show that with this book. I hope that I did. And it's interesting, too, because I'm also finding out that there are so many young people who feel like they have to be a different person in a different world. There are older people who feel like that. I've had elderly people come up to me and they're like, I totally understood what she was dealing with because I have to be one way at bingo and another way at home. And I'm like, okay, as long as you get it, you know. And it's interesting that so many of us, we're walking around with masks on, we're walking around not being our authentic selves, or we're afraid that our authentic selves will not be accepted in these different spaces, and we're basically holding ourselves back, and we're not letting those around us really get to know the true us. So the fact that so many people connect with that, in some ways it's good, but in some ways it's sad. And it tells me that so many of our young people especially feel like they have to be someone they're not in order to be accepted.
I mean, this thing about people wearing masks is so interesting to me, especially in the context of Maverick, because I may love him the most because I think he had to pull off a little bit of a literary trick with him, because it is so clear from the get-go that he's a really steady and thoughtful man. Except for his immediate family, Lisa and Star and Seven, it is clear that the rest of the world thinks that he's sort of wild and unsteady. And that seems like a difficult trick for a writer to pull off to me, to show how he really is and how the rest of the world perceives him.
Oh, that's, you know, I hadn't thought about it like that, but that's awesome. And you know what, though? But for me, that's honestly how, unfortunately, a lot of Black men are perceived. Mm-hmm. A lot of Maverick was inspired by Tupac Shakur. I often say that Maverick is what Tupac would have been if he would have been a dad and he wasn't famous. As you know, I love your reaction. So with Pac, that's really how it was. People who knew Tupac, they say in personal and his private life, he was nothing like the way he came across in like his music or in interviews and stuff. He came off as this harsh guy, this wild guy, this thug. Mm-hmm. But at home, they were like, he was like a big teddy bear. He was so generous and he was so sweet and thoughtful. And he was all of those things, but he was perceived as being something that he was at times.
Yeah.
But that perception is what people define him by.
Right.
And so for me, that's how it is with Maverick. Yeah, at home, he's the big teddy bear. But I think for someone like Maverick, he feels as if he has to portray himself as being harsh in the world because he wants to protect his family. And sometimes that's the only way he knows how.
Yeah.
When it comes to someone like King, he has to be that way.
Yeah.
So it's in a lot of ways, when you put it like that, he has to be two different people in the world and at home.
Yeah. And for Tupac, I mean, that had fatal consequences.
Yes. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you're a tremendous fan.
Yeah. I could talk about that guy all day.
I saw your socks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I brought them. I didn't wear them because they wouldn't go with this outfit, but I brought them. Yeah. I'm a huge fan. But what's interesting to me is really getting to look at Tupac, the artist, and the person, and how the person influenced his music and even his acting, and how he really became some of the roles he first portrayed as an actor. And it's also interesting to me, too, because he was a walking, talking contradiction. I will be the first to say it. I can criticize Pac quicker than anybody. But that's because I love what he did, and I can look past that and say, yeah, you were wrong in this, but I also see where you were right in this.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very interesting guy. I think he was probably one of the most complex hip-hop artists we've had.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, too, because to some people, if you talk to them about Tupac, one person will say, oh, that was a thug, gangster, rapper. Another will say, oh, he was a poet, he was an artist. But the fact is, in a lot of ways, he was all of those things.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you about the sort of main incident of police brutality in mm-hmm. this book. And it's not really giving too much away because it shows up relatively early in the book.
Also because millions of people have read that
book. Right. I can basically talk about whatever I want to. As book groups, we always have to be careful, but not with this book. But, you know, in real life, in this country, incidents of mm-hmm. police brutality have tragically become, you know, really common. And even though the details of any one of those cases is different, I mean, it may happen in a different city. For example, you know, when those videos go viral, there seems to be mm-hmm. a really tragic similarity to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, seems like a tricky thing for a writer because mm-hmm. I just was wondering how you got into that scene where Khalil is murdered by the police officer. Were you looking at those videos? Were you trying to step aside from them to write something totally different?
I tried to step aside from them, but the fact of the matter is that, like you were saying, there's always this thread that seems to connect all of them, that they all share. And it's always young Black people in America, when they get killed in these cases, it's because an assumption was made about them that was totally wrong.
Yeah.
George Zimmerman assumed that Trayvon Martin was up to no good, and that's what led him to kill him.
Yeah.
The cop who killed Michael Brown assumed he was up to no good. Tamir Rice was assumed to be about, they assumed that he was about to shoot them. So all of these assumptions, that's what leads to these cases. So that was like the one thing I knew that I would have to do. It had to be an assumption that led to that moment. And the fact is, that comes from prejudice, bigotry, racism. The fact that you'd assume that a young Black person is up to no good, where does that come from? That comes from stereotypes. That comes from this and that. So that comes from prejudice. That comes from racial bias, all of that. So there's that. But for me, the unfortunate thing has been, this is something I came up with, you know, Khalil and how that moment actually happened. And now I'm seeing stuff like that happen.
Yeah.
You know, when I saw the Philando Castile video, this was after I wrote the book, and I remember seeing that video, and it reminded me too much, the fact that his girlfriend was sitting there in the car right when it happened, and the officer thought he was reaching for a gun, it reminded me too much of Khalil. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing it, unfortunately, happen too closely to the way it happened in the book. But I tried not to watch too many videos, because honestly, for my mental health's sake, it's sure. a lot. But sometimes, especially now in the day of social media, you get bombarded with these things. And I just had to really look at the videos and look at the cases and say, what's the common thread? What leads young black men to getting killed in these situations is always an assumption.
A quote that this part of our conversation got me thinking mm-hmm. about. And it's, the truth casts a shadow over the kitchen. People like us in situations like this become hashtags, but they rarely get justice. I think we all wait for that one time, though, that one time when it ends right. Mm-hmm. Is that an important quote to you? And could you place it in a little bit of context for us?
Oh, yeah, sure. That is definitely an important quote for me. And I think really that's like at the heart of the Black Lives Matter movement. We want justice. We're waiting for at some point for things to, for a person who is killed in these sorts of cases to actually be treated like a victim. Mm-hmm. Trayvon Martin is called a thug more than he's called a victim. You know, so we're all waiting for that time where it's like they're not saying, oh, you're overreacting. Oh, he deserved it. Oh, this is just the way it goes. We're waiting for that one time where the justice system actually serves justice to a young person of color. And I think, too, the fact is, I can name plenty of hashtags. I can name plenty of people who've become hashtags. You compare that number to the people who've actually received justice in these cases. It is insane. Yeah. You know, it seems like just about every week another person becomes a hashtag, and people criticize hashtag justice, as they call it, but we wouldn't know these names if it wasn't for hashtags. These things have been happening for decades. If it wasn't for social media and the fact that people have videos now and we can connect with one another and be aware of things that are happening beyond our own backyard, we wouldn't know about it. So I'm thankful for hashtags, but I'm sad that we have more hashtags than we have good endings.
So tell us what's next. Mm-hmm. I mean, no pressure.
No pressure.
Tell us everything.
A major best-selling novel.
Well, the Hate U Give film adaptation comes out October 19th.
Yeah, so yes. Are you involved in that? Like, how? Tell us about.
I do have a cameo.
I do?
Yeah, I'm listed as an executive producer, and I was consulted a lot. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that a lot of heart and soul went into this project. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times readers are very hesitant about movies, and they're like, I don't want to see it because it's going to ruin the book. I will have to say that this one does not. Yeah. It does an amazing job from what I got to witness on set. So that's in October. My second book comes out in February, and it's called On the Come Up. And it's not a sequel or a spinoff to The Hate U Give. A lot of young readers like to ask me, why won't you do a sequel? Guys, I have to put Star through a lot for mm-hmm. a sequel. I think I've ruined her life enough. So no, it's not a sequel. It's set in the same neighborhood. And it's about a 16-year-old girl named Brianna who wants to be a rapper. But her life is turned upside down when, one, her mom unexpectedly loses her job, and two, a song that she makes goes viral for all the wrong reasons. Oh. And for me, this is my take on what it means to be young, black, in America when freedom of speech isn't always free. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. So February 2019.
Yes, February 5th.
All right.
I got that right. There's so many dates in my head.
We will be eager to look for it. But screenwriting is not an interest of yours. You didn't get mm-hmm. involved in writing the script for the movie version.
Well, I made tweaks. They did have me tweak the script bits and pieces to make sure the voice was right, because that was a big thing for the director. He wanted Star's voice to be authentic to the book. So
realism, you were sort of the guardian of realism.
Yeah, that would be a good way of putting it.
You're one of those elaborate Google job titles, you know, like master of fun, you know.
I like it. I'm going to tell them to credit me as that.
So homeschooling. How did that go?
Oh, for me, you know, people are always surprised when they find out that I was homeschooled. It was for the last year of middle school and all of high school. Okay. My mom was an educator. And it was honestly, it came from the decision was made because, for one, the schools in my area were performing very poorly. Mm-hmm. And two, I was bullied a lot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you're the smart kid, you're the target. Mm-hmm. And so my mom knew that it was having an effect on me emotionally, mentally, and in her mind, in order to save me, even though she couldn't afford private school, the best thing she knew to do was bring me home and homeschool me. So for me, honestly, I say that homeschooling laid the foundation for me as a writer now, because it taught me independent study. It taught me how to work without someone looking over my shoulder saying, get it done. You know, I may get an email every now and then checking in on me, but it's not like, it really teaches you discipline. Yeah. So that's one thing I learned with it. But it also, it allowed me to become a writer because in school, I was sometimes, classmates made me feel like books and writing, that was nerd stuff. Why would you want to do that? That's why I became a rapper, because I wanted to be cool. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. It was like, why would you want to tell stories? So I thought rapping was the only way to do it, but I sucked at it. So, No, I did. I can say that. But it taught me, what I came to realize was, if I want to tell stories, I can tell them however I want to tell them. So when I started homeschooling, my mom encouraged me to express myself however I wanted to. If I wanted to write stories, she said, write them. Do it. And that was one of the best things that could have happened for me. So I'm a huge advocate for it for certain kids. I think it benefits certain kids a whole lot. It really did for me. And that's why my mom is now like, yep, you owe me.
Well, I want to say, like, how great to have a mom who, like, that's a huge sacrifice, you know?
It was.
I mean, she was a teacher, but still, like.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was. But she says it was an investment. That's how she sees it. So
We thank your mom for her investment. We praise your mom for her investment. But I noticed this book is dedicated to your grandmother.
Yes, yes. My mom, when she actually homeschooled me, she was also coming home to become a full-time caregiver for my grandmother, who had dementia and who was bedridden. But one thing that it was always interesting to me, sometimes my grandmother couldn't remember my name. She couldn't remember where she was, but she was always positive. She was always finding the light in the darkness. So for me, knowing that someone who was once so up and about and was so independent, if she could find a way to be happy in the midst of all of the things that were happening to her health-wise, it taught me that I can find that light in the darkness and keep going. So yeah. I dedicated it to her. So she passed a few years ago, but I hope she's proud.
Yeah, I'm sure she is. The book is The Hate U Give. We've just been talking to Angie Thomas, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Podcast fans, do not miss John Taffer, No Excuses, a brand new show from Podcast One. Shut it down and listen to John, award-winning hospitality legend from Bar Rescue, as he brings his straight talk and unapologetic approach to daily topics and current events. You don't want to miss his latest interview with Adam Carolla. Subscribe and download John Taffer, No Excuses, every Tuesday exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. And also remember to rate and review. We always appreciate your feedback. So Megan, it's time for us to talk about MeUndies. I'm an underwear company. The first line of the ad says, take a moment to think about your underwear. But you and I, we don't really ever stop talking about our underwear, do we?
No, I know. It's a little weird, right? But if your first thought isn't, I have the best underwear, then hear us out on MeUndies.
MeUndies are made with a material sustainably sourced from beechwood trees. Their naturally soft fiber makes a fabric that won't sag down or ride up. With MeUndies, you can get undies sent right to your door. No more hunting around for the perfect pair at a crowded store.
Hate that. MeUndies is so sure you'll love your first pair that if you're not happy, they'll do whatever they can to get you into the right pair. And if they can't, keep them and they'll refund you. So it really is risk-free, Clay, to try the best underwear ever.
And for listeners of Fully Booked, you get 15% off your first pair of MeUndies and free shipping. That's right. Just go to MeUndies.com/Kirkus for your 15% off your first pair, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
In fact, since we are overflowing with generosity, here's an extra gift for you. Order a pair, take a screenshot of your transaction, and send it to us, and we'll send you another pair. You get one for 15% off, and then you get another pair from us for free.
The first 25 people to send a proof of purchase, a screenshot of your purchase or of the receipt, will send you another pair free. Just send your proof to gift@podcastone.com, put Kirkus in the subject line, and you will soon have another pair in your collection. Again, that's gift@podcastone.com.
One more time, MeUndies.com/Kirkus. Check it out. And one more time, that's a picture of the receipt, not you in your MeUndies.
Yeah, please don't do that to us.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
It'd be fascinating to see where she goes next, Megan.
Oh, yeah. I am a fan for life now.
And I loved what she was saying about the, you know, darkness. Light from darkness. I mean, it's amazing, you know, she dedicated the book to her grandmother because of that. But this book itself, I think, has given a lot of sort of light to people who see themselves reflected in the book. And even for people who don't see themselves reflected directly in the book, I mean, it gives them deeper understanding about police brutality in this country, you know?
Absolutely. And the more stories we can get from the more perspectives we can get, the better we can understand one another.
And there are a lot of other social issue or social justice books that are out there. There's one you love. You interviewed Lisa Cove for us, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. That was one of actually my first podcast interviews last year when we still did separate interviews.
Yeah.
Ye olde format. She is great. I've also done a couple of events with her. There was one at Powell's Books, and also she was on a panel I was moderating at the Texas Book Festival last year. Mm-hmm. And I just think she's great. The paperback of The Leavers rather recently came out, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure what date that was. It's an incredible book. Just to recap, it's a book about a young man named Deming. Daniel is the new name he's given when he's adopted by white foster parents in upstate New York. And his mother, Polly, comes from China, seeking a better life. And she actually ends up in a detention camp for illegal immigrants in Texas, a place that Coe calls Ardsleysville in the book. But it's based on an actual former detention camp that existed. And a lot of timely issues are dealt with in this book.
Well, there's going to be one coming up in September that I'm really excited about called American Prison, and it's by Shane Bauer. And he writes about privately run prisons in this country, and he focuses on one in Louisiana. And he did that, you know, participatory undercover journalism thing of becoming a prison guard there.
Mm-hmm.
Although, jeez, as the corporation likes to call it, correctional officers.
Right.
For, I think, 4 months. And so he writes about his own experience, which, of course, harkens back to this great book by Ted Conover, Guarding Sing Sing, from, I think, the late 90s or early 2000s, in which Ted Conover also became a prison guard and wrote about the famous Sing Sing prison, you know, from the inside in that way. So look for that one in September. It's getting a ton of great buzz. And you also interviewed the author of this book, which is actually, the book is titled This Book Betrays My Brother.
Yeah, the author's name is Kahiso Lesejo-Molope. She's originally from South Africa. She lives in Canada now. And this is technically a YA book, but again, another one that's that I would recommend to readers of all ages. Well, mature readers, because it's one of those books that...
There's some tough stuff going on.
There's some tough stuff going on in this book. In brief, it's about... The narrator is 13 years old when she sees her beloved older brother's violent assault of another girl, a girl from the local township. They come from a relatively privileged family, and what the family and the community do to insulate him from any retribution is pretty intense. So in light of the Me Too movement, this is like going to seem powerfully prescient to North American readers in 2018. The interesting thing about it is it was first published in South Africa in 2012. It won awards and, you know, it was actually written in response to the trial of politician Jacob Zuma, who, after he was acquitted of rape, became president of South Africa.
Yeah, and was recently, I guess, deposed might be the right word.
Yes, very recently.
Yeah.
So, this book is very powerful, and it's really interesting because what she does is emphasize the witness's point of view, as opposed to, you know, in these exchanges, you say it's, you know, between two people, but really the role of the witness and why we should tell what we know and the perils of doing that.
No, but it is amazing that it was published, I think you said 2012, and in South Africa, and it just, you know, it's published for the first time in America this year, but it fits right into the Me Too conversation that we're having. So,
oh my gosh, especially like the last lines of this book are incredible.
You got to make it through to the end. Okay.
Got to make it. And it won't be hard. It's like one of those books that just pulls you right along.
See, book critics have to make it to the last lines of the book. That's our job. But
that's our job.
You listeners are... readers, and you can stop whenever you want to, but with this one, we encourage you to actually finish the entire thing. So we've got other recommendations from our editors. Let's call them up and see what they're liking.
Let's do it. Let's be honest, Clay. Most of us, besides me, are brushing our teeth wrong.
Most of us do brush our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brushes on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different?
Let me tell you. For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes. Also, Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides.
And Quip has subscription plans, and with their subscription plans, they are focused on your health. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. And check this out. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth.
Finally, everyone loves Quip, featured by Oprah, Time Magazine, and having the distinction of being the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association.
Quip starts at just $25, and for all you fully booked listeners, if you go to getquip.com/Kirkus right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush.
Again, that's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/Kirkus. GETQUIP.com/Kirkus. Do it for your teeth. We're joined now by our editors for their top picks in books for 7-3. We have children's editor Vicky Smith, YA editor Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Vicky, what's your pick for children's books this week?
My pick is called The Last. It's by Catherine Applegate, who won the Newbery for the one and only Ivan a few years ago. And this kicks off a series that has a... it's sort of got this disconnect between world building and plot, but it really works. So on the cover of this book, you see a couple of really adorable animals, and one looks kind of like a flying squirrel with enormous ears, and the other one looks like a bipedal dog. And
okay, cute.
So They're very cute. And, you know, for a kid who is like the kid I used to be, who read anything that had a talking animal in it, it's just going to be a magnet. But the story opens, and very quickly, the main character, who is this fantasy bipedal dog-like creature, very quickly finds herself the one and only example of her species left in this fantasy world. And I mean, it's just awful. And so she is left with no family, no community, no people, and must cobble together a found family among other inhabitants of this fantasy land. And so it deals with really, really heavy stuff. The reviewer said themes of genocide, conservation, and magic are interwoven, providing thought-provoking questions for astute readers and educators. And you know, the writing stands up to the themes. Although the cover says cute, fuzzy talking animals, these are talking animals with full agency and full sort of awareness of the enormity of what has happened to them. So it's a very neat read.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting reading the review. There are six species in the book, only one of which are humans, and they're all made up. Felivets, natites, they have all these kind of tote names that have no relation to any words that we know. And I thought it was interesting because I felt like in most fantasy series, say The Hobbit, you know, there are hobbits, but then all the other, you know, different creatures are things we're familiar with, elves, wizards, dwarves, you know, but Applegate here seems to have created a whole new world with tons of different species. And, you know, I wondered if it could be confusing at all or if you just get right into it.
Oh, I think you just get right into it. I mean, particularly kids who are really, you know, they're accustomed to stuff that they don't know about. They, you know, most 8 to 12 year olds, or this book is, that's the book's audience, are not, they don't have firsthand familiarity with this. They haven't been acculturated to all of these expectations. They are still in the mode of being acculturated. So, you know, a Wabik is no different from an elf. You know, yes, elves exist in folklore, but they are just as unfamiliar as these other things, and they're furry creatures. So you've got the, I cannot leave that alone. So you've got the familiarity of the furry mammal thing with these odd names, which sort of keeps them, which I think helps them be regarded as adults with agency instead of, you know, pets. So it's very conscious, and Applegate is very good at sort of setting up expectations and then kind of turning them a little bit so that readers are able to get everything that's going on without a whole lot of confusion. She's really good at it. I don't think kids would have trouble.
Yeah, thank you for that. Laura, what is happening in YA?
So there's a new book out called Zen and Gone by Emily France, and it focuses on two main characters. There's a boy called Oliver, and he's a city boy from Chicago. His sister has just been hospitalized due to her schizophrenia, and there was an event, a sort of catastrophic event that was alluded to, and the parents feel like it'd be better if he went to spend the summer with his aunt in Boulder, Colorado. And he's just not happy. You know, it's like, what's he going to do in Boulder? But he meets this girl named Essa, who has this very precocious, highly gifted little sister called Puck. And the girl's mother it's basically a case of role reversal. The mom is a pothead who kind of can't get her act together, and Essa is sort of serving as the responsible adult in the family, even though she's still in high school. And she's really into Zen Buddhism and her own sort of orienteering game that she and her friends invented, where somebody drops them somewhere in the wilderness and they have to find their way to a particular point. So the book is sort of a wilderness adventure. There's also a puzzle at one point. Puck sneaks along and follows them on one of these trips and then gets lost in the wilderness. It's also a romance. It's a really interesting book because on the one hand, it's pretty action-packed, but it's also about faith and spirituality. And I was thinking about how there are religious publishers, but there aren't a lot of mainstream young adult books that really explore faith in a positive way, especially a non-Western religions. So I enjoyed that aspect of the book as well.
Hey, Laura, I wanted to ask you about the setting. My parents have lived in Boulder for about 15 years, so I'm pretty familiar with the landscape. And I just wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about how, you know, it seems like it plays a pretty big role with the orienteering and all that. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes. In fact, I would say Boulder is almost like a character in the book itself. And I've never been there, but I feel like I've been there now. I mean, just the author, at least again, to me, not having been there, feels like she really conveys the essence of the place. She describes, you know, the college yeah. students and all the little shops and kind of alternate and just all these little indie stores and restaurants, and also the mountains surrounding it. And you learn a lot about orienteering and wilderness survival, but it never feels like this kind of info dump book. You know, there are those books where you feel like, oh, the author did so much research and it's all in there. This is all seamless. You know, you get this strong sense of Boulder and how to survive if you were in the mountains, you know, without a tent and so on, in this really fascinating way.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Don't go too far, Eric. We're on to nonfiction. What's your pick for the week?
My pick is The World As It Is, a memoir of the Obama White House by Ben Rhodes. And Rhodes was, his official title was Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communication. Quite long, I know. And he was named that when he was 29, so pretty young. He was working in a D.C. think tank before he joined Obama's campaign in 2007 or 2008, and then worked for the administration for both terms. And there's kind of been this raft of books of former Obama staffers that have come out, and, you know, they're very up and down. I think this is probably one of the better ones. It's a really, really thoughtful, or what our reviewer said, it's a thoughtful, thorough exploration of the grindingly slow workings of national security and the inevitable compromises of government. So I think he goes a lot deeper than a lot of these other things that a lot of these other books have. It's not really a tell-all. You know, he reveals some details about Obama, but it's definitely not just, it's not gossipy. It's pretty mm-hmm. serious, but highly readable as well. So I think if you're looking for a good picture of what the Obama White House was like, this is probably your best bet.
Yeah, I found a lot of the coverage of this book when it first, you know, was being buzzed about, that it came off as gossipy, you know, learn what mm-hmm. Obama thought about, really thought about Trump. And I'm so right. pleased to hear that it's more substantial than that, because, you know, if you have an epoch-making presidency, you don't want it to be reduced to, you know, gossip. So I'm really excited to hear about this and to get a more nuanced sense of the book. So thanks, Eric.
No, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, it's kind of a shame that that's how the book was positioned in a lot of ways. And I think that's a lot of, how a lot of these books were positioned. And I get it from, you know, from one point of view, if you want to bring people in, it's kind of the clickbait phenomenon. But it was refreshing to read something that, and he's a good writer. So it's a really, really thoughtful look at, you know, the 8 years of the Obama presidency.
Cool. Thanks.
So, Laurie, what novel are you liking this week?
I am liking less. liking it more.
Yes.
No, I was so happy to see this book on the bestseller list. It's so unusual when, you know, something does sort of okay when it comes out, and then like a year later, it pops up on the bestseller list. The book is Less by Andrew Sean Greer, and it's about a man named Arthur Less, who is approaching his 50th birthday, which he's not very happy about. And he spent a long time being the much younger boyfriend of an older, very famous poet. And he's just used to being this sort of young, pretty person in a group. And now he's going to be 50. And his second long-term boyfriend, who was 9 years younger than him, which kind of contradicts what I just said, but it doesn't really, it works in the book. They've broken up, and his younger boyfriend is now getting married. So Arthur wants to get out of town, which is San Francisco where they live, doesn't want to be sitting at home during the day of the wedding, and also certainly doesn't want to go to the wedding. So what he does is he's a novelist. He portrays himself as a very sort of bottom feeding, novelist of the literary world, not very successful. But he goes to a drawer and he digs out all these invitations that he had never answered. And it turns out he has an invitation to go speak in New York and get a prize in Paris, I think, just do various literary things in all different places around the world. And he hopscotches from one to the other. And the whole book is him sort of comically flailing around the world while, trying to teach a course in German and things like that. And I guess I really haven't said this, but the really notable thing about this book is it is just so funny, just hilarious, but also, touching. And the voice, the narrator, who narrates in this very sort of arch voice, talking about Arthur Less and what he's like and what he does, is a real presence in the book. And you kind of think maybe it's a sort of 18th century, 19th century narrator. But then sort of later in the book, you discover it is actually someone who, and it's kind of a surprise who the narrator turns out to be. So all in all, very funny.
So funny. But I mean, like, show of hands, who in 100,000 million years thought this exceptional novel was going to win the Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah.
Like, I was shocked. I was shocked.
I think the author was surprised too.
Yes.
He said so on Twitter.
What the book is about, which is a sort of perpetually unsuccessful novelist, you can just, I don't think of Andrew Sean Greer as a perpetually unsuccessful novelist. And I don't know if that's how he thinks of himself, but, it must have been quite a thrill to win the prize.
I interviewed him when it came out for the magazine, and he said that, he actually was having trouble just getting that novel off the ground. And when he just kind of, let it fly, out came Less.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get off the hold list of the library so I can read it myself. But Laurie, it's interesting what you said. I was curious whether you feel like funny books are often underrated, because I love humor, but it's so hard to do well. And I think sometimes people who write funny books don't get all, the acknowledgement they deserve for how difficult it is.
I definitely think that's true. So I think everybody was surprised to see this win the Pulitzer because of that. I've been on a lot of prize committees, and I can't count the number of times I've sat in a room where people were saying, wouldn't it be nice to have a comic novel, on the shortlist or, win this prize? I think people are aware of it, that comedy tends to be underrated, but somehow that book never usually ends up being, everyone thinking this is the best book. So it was very nice to see that happen for this book.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, guys. That's some great picks this week. I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsors who bring our podcast to you free every week, specifically Me Undies and Quip Toothbrushes. Please support them because they support us. That's our show for this week. Next week, we're going to be talking to Otessa Mosveg, whose new novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, is about a young New York woman who decides that there's nothing wrong with her existence, but she's going to take a few months off and nap during the whole thing. So I'm excited to ask her for some tips about hibernating, because I've been wondering how to do that myself. So until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Everyone's favorite housewife is back, and she's ready for round two. Step into Heather DeBro's world now twice a week on Podcast One.
I loved it.
Heather's bringing you more of what you love, like YouTube's Glozell.
And now you got a beautiful, healthy
yes.
little
yes, she's
girl
healthy.
Who's going to hate you in 13 years. Right. And you're going to go, do you know how much I paid for you?
Roll the tape. Roll the tape.
Do you see?
Check out Heather DeBro's world every Thursday and Friday at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Also remember to rate and review.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.